Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm chair of the club's business and leadership forum here, and it's my pleasure to introduce your host for today's program, Kathy Curtis. Kathy Curtis has been a longtime volunteer and is a member-led forum chair at the Commonwealth Club. She is a certified financial planner, investment advisor, and founder of her firm, Curtis Financial Planning. She helps women to manage her finances. Today's program is the aftermath of Me Too in the workplace. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished host and bring us into the light, Kathy Curtis.
Hello, everyone. It's my pleasure to introduce our two speakers tonight. First, Amy Oppenheimer is an attorney, investigator, member of the Department of Fair Housing and Employment, Sexual Harassment Workforce, and an author of a book on how to do workplace investigations. She is a former plaintiff's attorney who in the 1980s represented women who had been sexually harassed and founded a professional organization for workplace investigators that is now international and about 1,000 members strong. Chaya Mandelbaum is an employment law attorney and partner at Rudy Axelrod Zief & Lowe and chair for the California Fair Employment and Housing Council. He was appointed to this position by Governor Brown and confirmed by the California Senate. He has extensive experience in wage and hour discrimination, retaliation, harassment, and leave of absence matters. So please help me in welcoming our speakers who will entertain us with a great conversation on this very important topic.
Thank you. And I'm very thrilled to be here. You know, usually when I speak, I'm speaking to lawyers and human resource professionals, and now I'm speaking to a room with a lot of familiar faces of people who usually don't come hear me speak, which is very nice. And I'm really glad to be here with Chaya. We're both on the task force that was put together by Kevin Kish, the director of the Fair Employment and Housing Department of Fair Employment and Housing, which he put together on the 10-year anniversary of our law that provides for mandatory training and in sexual harassment. And the point was to sort of look at where we'd come in 10 years, and this happened before the Me Too movement, so we were already looking at what we'd accomplished, what we needed to accomplish. And when I was asked to speak about this, and I couldn't think of who would be a great person for me to speak with, I have to give a shout out to my wife, who said, well, you've talked a lot about Chaya Mandelbaum. What about him? And so this is proof that I'm lucky to be married to somebody who listens to me. I don't know if it's always the case the other way around. We want to talk about what we've done on the task force a little bit to give some history of this issue and then talk about where we see things going. And one of the things that Chaya's been working on is looking at training. And I know that's something that people are very aware of, that we have to have training, sometimes a lot of criticism of the training that's out there. And so I was hoping that you would talk about what the task force has found about training, what kind of changes might be afoot, and whether you think that we have accomplished what we wanted to.
Right. So notwithstanding the prevalence of sex harassment that Me Too impressed upon people, there have been existing efforts for a long time to address pervasive sexual harassment, in particular in California, which has been a leader in this area in certain respects. One of which, as Amy just mentioned, is mandatory sexual harassment prevention training. So in California, for over a decade now, if you're employed by an employer with 50 or more people, employees, you're required to attend, if you're a supervisor, sexual harassment prevention training. And by show of hands, how many people have participated in a training like that? Okay, now leave your hands up if you think that training impressed upon would-be harassers and decreased the likelihood of harassment. So unfortunately, most social science research so far is about as scientifically valid as that poll was. And the reason for that is because there isn't a whole lot of examined data. California is one of the only states that has mandated this, and that's one of the points of this sexual harassment prevention task force that we're on, is to say, look, we now have over 10 years of data, comprehensive data in California, about how people are implementing this training requirement and what's working and what isn't. So that's part of what we are looking at right now. There's an assembled team of academics led by a law professor at Stanford that have created an interview for employers to look at kind of what, how training is implemented in California and what's worked and what hasn't. What we know so far, just on a national level and in a less scientific study, is that training is not a magic bullet in and of itself. It won't cure sex harassment, certainly. It needs to be part of a holistic environment, starting from the top and leadership. I mean, if leadership's not talking the talk and walking the walk, no amount of formalized training is going to really fix an environment. And also that training focused overly on legal compliance itself is not an effective type of training. It needs to be more of a training about environment. And to the state's credit, there have been recent amendments to the training requirement that predate Me Too. One was to add what's called abusive conduct training. So now, as part of the sexual harassment training, in addition to the things that you would, you know, may have received in your training or would intuit would be part of a sex harassment training, you have to talk about abusive conduct in the workplace more generally. So even if it's not tied to sex or religion or another discriminatory category, you're educating employees about the detriments to just an abusive working environment in general. Similarly, even more recently, but also predating the Me Too movement, was an amendment to add sexual orientation and gender identity and expression to the sex harassment training. Those are often very intersectional, and so that's now included in California's training. But in terms of the results of the task force, it's to be determined, as the academics have started their polling of employers, de-identified to the employers so that they'd participate. So we should hopefully learn more about what works and what doesn't when it comes to training.
Well, I know some of this also was looked at by the EEOC, by the federal agency that enforces the harassment laws. And they were pretty critical of some of the training. I know in my own experience, I've seen training where the attitude is, every employee is a potential plaintiff, so here's how to protect yourself from being sued, which doesn't have a whole lot of impact on changing behavior and making it a nice work environment. But one of the things I think the EEOC was looking at is respectful workplace training and bystander training, as opposed to just, you know, harassment prevention training. And is that something that you know about that we're looking at in terms of the task force, or changes afoot?
Yeah, you know, I think that is part of what they're examining as to who's attending trainings, because only supervisors have to attend trainings, but that doesn't mean that others can't. So some employers, I think, do pool from a larger group for their mandated trainings. And certainly that's been an approach that's used on campuses for sex violence, mm-hmm. on campuses, to engage bystanders and encourage them to feel responsible for creating that environment. And oftentimes it's easier for them to report because they're not, mm-hmm. you know, they don't have the same concerns of retaliation, albeit there may be some, but but they don't have as severe of concerns as a victim may have.
Yeah, and I think anecdotally, I do see more and more other people bringing a complaint rather than the person who is the target, which is a way, I think, you know, that the bystander, the people who are around, can really help see that rules and expectations are enforced and not put all of the focus on the person who was the target of the behavior.
Well, and one issue you have in any objective understanding of the conditions of sex harassment in the workplace is defining results. So unlike other areas, an employer reporting that they had zero sex harassment complaints is not necessarily indicative of success.
Well, exactly. And I hear that still frequently. Well, we've never had a complaint before, so we must be a great work environment. Not so much. The reality is that no employer can hire perfectly, and so there are going to be problems. There are going to be people who cross lines. It may be very serious, it may be less serious, but it's going to happen. And so when I look for what is an employer that shows they have a vigorous, successful program, I would expect that there were complaints, and that what I would hope is that people felt they could complain. No complaints might mean that people feel like there's going to be retaliation, so I'm never going to complain here. That's not a good thing. And we've been doing, one of the things I think that's changed some in my practice is more doing surveys for employers of what is the environment like, anonymous surveys where they can find out, were you a target? Did you see anybody else? Did you complain? Why or why not? Were you satisfied with those results? And my concern is when we're seeing results that people are complaining but weren't satisfied with the results, or not complaining because of the fear of retaliation.
Well, so another existing obligation in California for employers is to take reasonable steps to prevent sex harassment in the first place and to correct it when it happens. And as part of the task force, you have led, along with a colleague, the creation of a guide for employers. Basically, how do you implement an effective sex harassment policy in general? So I'm sure the audience would love to know kind of what are the ingredients of both complying with that requirement and creating that environment more generally.
Yeah, one of the task force. When did we start the task force?
A year and a half ago,
something like that. Okay, and the research that Chaya talked about for training, the efficacy of training, that's a more of a long-term project to do that study. What we did in the meantime, though, is we put together a guide for employers. What does the prevention program look like? And some of it focuses on what kind of policies you should have, how they should be distributed. What people have been hearing, I think, in the Me Too movement all the time is buy-in from the top. You got to walk the walk and talk the talk, or you're not going to have change. And then there's a lot of detail about how employers should respond to complaints. And one of my pet peeves is that in the employment arena, the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar are often very far apart. And the more I think we can collaborate, the better. And when I've been at recent conferences, I've heard from both plaintiff and defense, this is a good guide. It's telling employers what to do and employees what to expect, and it gives a roadmap and then something to aspire to and to follow. And no investigation and response may be perfect, but if you follow these guidelines, then you're going to be, and you do it in good faith and timely, then you're going to be compliant and doing the right thing.
And what I like about the guide is it addresses a lot of the issues in workplace investigations that are the thorniest and that come up the most frequently. So one thing that comes up a lot is the scenario where a victim of sexual harassment comes forward, summons the courage, and reports to HR an issue, but is concerned rightfully, statistically, about retaliation and wants to report it, but wants to maintain their confidentiality and doesn't want it getting out there. So what does a responsible employer do with respect to an investigation once someone has come forward, both with, you know, serious allegations, but also a desire for a level of confidentiality?
I think for a long time that employers have been told and that they need to take action, even if somebody wants confidentiality. Usually somebody who comes forward does that because they do want action, so you can usually work with them successfully. Sometimes employers don't take action and there's repeated behavior, there are other victims or targets, and that's a problem. What's become really difficult in the law is how what you can keep confidential during an investigation, what confidentiality can you ask for, and what confidentiality do people want and insist on it? And we have a tension between people wanting to keep something confidential and people wanting things to be transparent. And so what I've heard a lot in the Me Too movement is we want to be heard. We don't want these confidentiality clauses. We don't want these secret agreements. We want to be able to speak out and be heard. On the other hand, some people who bring complaints don't want to be heard. And you know, I don't know if I'm sort of jumping ahead of where we were going to talk. And some people say, well, you want confidentiality, but I want transparency. So whose need trumps whose need? You can't have full transparency and have full confidentiality. And you have the interests of the complainant, and you have the interests of the respondent. And one of the things the guide addresses is everybody's supposed to get due process, basic fairness. And so you've got those competing needs, and then you've got witnesses, somebody who works with these people who says, I don't want them to know what I said. You're going to tell them what I said? Well, what can and can't be kept confidential vis-a-vis my information? And there isn't a perfect balance between those interests. But to go back to your earlier question, but you do need to take action. You can't just say, well, if you want to keep it confidential, then we won't do anything.
Well, speaking of due process, one thing that comes up for sex harassment complaints in particular is the classic he said, she said scenario where there isn't a smoking gun email. And as a plaintiff's attorney, that's the first thing I'm looking for. Like, send me emails or texts. The bane of my evidentiary existence is these new ones that disappear, like Snapchat.
And you would be amazed at what people say in emails and texts. You would think they would know better. But anyway.
Including employment lawyers.
Okay.
But where none of that smoking gun type evidence exists, and it is just pure testimony, what do you do in a he said, she said scenario as a workplace investigator?
Yeah, pet peeve of enforcement agencies for years is that usually it's sort of an internal HR who's not really trained and they're doing investigations and they say, well, I don't know, she said, he said, who can tell? There's no evidence. Well, there is evidence because what she said and what he said is, it's not technically evidence like in court, but it's information. And you have to evaluate the credibility of that information. And you have to go through a credibility analysis. And the fact that there aren't really what people say mean when they say he said, she said, is that there's no independent corroboration. And that's what people like me have to do, is do an analysis and make a finding based on a preponderance of the evidence, which is the civil standard, as to whether it was more likely or not that it happened the way she said, or it didn't happen, or maybe something in between. But you can't just not make a finding. And it's a big responsibility.
What happens where the investigator... So oftentimes if you report to HR, let's say, as a victim of harassment or someone who feels that they've been a victim, and there is an internal infrastructure of sorts, some amount of investigation capability internally, and then if for one reason or another that's not sufficient, they bring in the big guns like yourself. So what happens if the person internally is the source of the accusations?
Well, if the person internally who's supposed to investigate, the accusations are against them?
Yeah, I mean, the default is to report to a supervisor or to report to HR. Well, what if that's the person that the employee has an issue with?
Sure. I mean, you know, employers should have multiple ways to complain, all the way up to the top. You shouldn't have... Really, you should be able to complain to anyone with any authority. But then the question is, who's going to investigate? And the ones that get sent out to folks like me are the ones where it is somebody who has a lot of authority, where you've got an HR person. I do like to tell HR that they're really not paid enough or given enough authority, and it makes me really popular at HR conferences that I say that. But, you know, they're doing this difficult job, but they don't necessarily have a lot of authority. And so there is a tremendous amount of pressure to make findings that they think is what the powers that be are going to want. And I think the way around that is you have HR report to the top. And, you know, if the problem is the top, you're going to have problems. But if you have the reporting directly to the top and that person is committed, then you've bypassed a lot of problems for HR. And when you don't have that, you know, that's where you're outsourcing and you're hiring somebody who's willing to make a hard call that may not be a popular call.
Yeah, you know, that somewhere someone told me once, and I tend to agree with it. I mean, there's a subset of HR that I feel like from in my experience as a plaintiff's lawyer is just out for protecting the company. But then there's a larger subset in fairness that I think is well-intentioned, but often powerless. So someone once told me HR is only as effective as the person that can fire them is. Hmm. And
that's a good way to say it.
That's really been my experience. If the person who can fire the HR person or hire the HR person isn't genuinely interested in getting to the bottom of it, HR is not going to be very effective.
Yeah, no, they have to feel that they have the kind of independence that I feel like I have, and I don't work for the company, and I'm willing to have somebody not hire me again because they didn't like my findings. I have enough clients, but there's a lot of pressure on HR.
Well, so notwithstanding the many requirements in place already, obviously we're all familiar that the Me Too movement has created an awareness of the prevalence of sex harassment in the workplace. And there are, because of that, a number of things that state and federal legislatures are considering to amend laws and to change, to try to impact that prevalence of sex harassment that hasn't gone away. So what's going on at the state legislature?
You're going to tell me about that, I think.
Fair
actually,
enough.
There's a lot going on. Let me actually circle back to one thing before we start talking about legislation, because there's a lot of legislation, and I think that just sort of going back to that HR outside investigator, I think one of the things that was already an issue but has become more clear to me as a result of the Me Too movement, is that there's a mistrust for HR, and there's really a mistrust often for folks like me who come from the outside. And sometimes that's hard for me because I think, well, I used to represent plaintiffs, and I, you know, I'm a good guy. And I understand the mistrust, and I also think that we've got to find a way to agree on some parameters so that there are trusted people who can do these investigations, or we don't have any solution. And it's one of my concerns because, again, and within the legal community, we're often very divided. And good prevention doesn't make for lawsuits. Good prevention goes contrary to the pocketbooks of attorneys on both sides. And so there's tension from the plaintiff's bar. It's never good enough. There's tension from the defense bar. You have to be even more rigorous in a way that's not necessarily helpful, and having cases sort of over-discovered so that they become very expensive. And it seems to me that the people who are getting the most out of that are the attorneys all around. And I often wonder, how do we build the trust for an independent investigator, for a solution within HR that can be trusted, that wouldn't go a litigation route, but would solve the problem at an earlier level? So I'll get off my soapbox about that. From what I understand, there's a lot of pending legislation, and I think some legislation that's already passed as a result of Me Too. And I know one of the big issues is the confidentiality of settlement agreements, which I think you come across much more than I do.
Yeah, and this is one that's really divided the plaintiff's bar. So I represent employees, many of whom are victims of harassment. And this is one that there is very little uniform understanding and position of, which is confidentiality. And it sort of became the headline, if you will, on the issues related to Me Too, that there that harassment behavior is buried under these confidentiality provisions. And I actually think we're arbitration, which we'll get to in a moment, is where a lot of that frustration should land. Confidentiality provisions, if states and federal legislatures are successful in banning them from sex harassment settlements, a couple of things will certainly result. One, victims of sex harassment will be paid a lot less. And two, employers will be unwilling to settle sex harassment complaints. And I think that's really unfair to put what people perceive as a macro solution onto individual victims of harassment. Not every plaintiff in a sex harassment case wants to be the next torchbearer for the Me Too movement. And so boxing them in and preventing those that choose a different path from getting full value of settlement or from maintaining their own confidentiality for purposes of future jobs and their reputation on the internet, I think is the wrong way to go about impacting this issue.
Do you think you're a minority in the plaintiff's bar? Because I've certainly heard the other point of view from your colleagues.
I'm certainly not the minority in my own office. But then again, I produce an environment of pure yes men and women.
Yeah. I don't disagree with you on the one hand. On the other hand, to represent the other viewpoints that I've heard, from what I've heard from other advocates, is that if you keep having confidential settlements, then you don't, it doesn't show a history that people then continue to get away with behavior and therefore perpetuates the behavior. And so that the societal good is to create a track record where you can see that somebody has crossed lines and, has harassed and targeted somebody and not keep sweeping it under the rug.
I think that's a well put counterpoint.
I'm channeling Ramit right now.
I appreciate that. One thing I think it's worth noting is, with a couple notable exceptions, in the news, Bill O'Reilly for one, most people that are accused of multiple sexual harassment complaints and force their employer to pay out millions of dollars settlements are promptly fired. So I don't want to dispel the notion that this is an issue, but I think we need to be very careful about pulling the rug under our victims unintentionally when it comes to mandating disclosure and settlements.
Well, I think that what you just brought up just sort of reminds me of one of the things that has become an issue is that what we hear in the headlines is this predatory, atrocious behavior that anybody would agree is terminable. And we know as lawyers and investigators that those cases exist and they're reprehensible and they're a small percentage of what we deal with. And so part of the issue with the Me Too movement is how do we craft changes that don't end up in a situation of unintended consequences. We're applying certain rules and ways of going forward to prevent and respond that are really excellent for the 1 or 5 or 10% of serious cases, but don't work so well for the other 90 or whatever percent of cases that are not as severe and wouldn't necessarily lead to termination.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
California. And you are listening to The Aftermath of Me Too in the Workplace with our expert speakers, Amy Oppenheimer and Chaya Mandelbaum.
So, Chaya, you said you were going to talk about arbitration agreements, which you seem to believe that the confidentiality the ban on confidentiality clauses was misplaced in that if instead we didn't allow arbitration for sexual harassment, that might solve the issue. Is that
That's fair? Right. I think that's really one of the ills in this kind of environment that we're operating in the workplace. For those of you that don't know this, many of you are probably already bound by them unwittingly or not as consumers or employees. But most employees at this point, I would say, or certainly anecdotally, are forced to sign at the start of their employment an agreement that prevents them from going to court. So they can never file a public complaint in state or federal court. They have to pursue it through a private mechanism called arbitration. And so what that really prevents is the subset of victims of harassment who want to bear that torch from going out and filing a public complaint and putting their harasser on blast. And so I absolutely think that the subset of women or men or victims in general of harassment who want to take that on and want to publicly report and be heard should have that opportunity. Unfortunately, there is a law pending in California right now to carve out sex harassment from mandatory arbitration. Unfortunately, California, both the judiciary and the legislature, has tried repeatedly to punch holes in mandatory arbitration. And the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly shot those efforts down, citing the Federal Arbitration Act and basically saying that this document that, in my editorialized opinion, was innocuous and meant for, you know, equal parties to be able to find a appropriate forum for their shipping dispute, that trumps everything, essentially. That cannot be infringed upon at even a state level. So the good news is that the Supreme Court ruling has to do with an act of Congress and not the Constitution, which would basically prevent anything from happening. And there was, at least, and may still be, a federal law working its way up, co-signed by Lindsey Graham, of all people, to carve out sex harassment from the FAA. Before that's done, whether the California legislature passes it or not, I have concerns about whether ultimately the Supreme Court will allow it.
And do you think arbitration is ever a good thing?
I think arbitration is a great thing when two equal parties genuinely decide to pursue it. I mean, there are oftentimes when neither side wants the expense, the publicity, and frankly, you can pick an expert in your topic. So an arbitrator, at least in my cases, is going to be someone that's very, very experienced in employment law, that understands those nuances, where a judge may be, you know, a general assigned judge that is a smart person, but has spent the last 3 years doing criminal law or family law. So it's not that arbitration is per se a bad thing. But mandating that employees pursue it or consumers pursue it is a bad thing. The biggest injustice related to arbitration in my eyes is not sex harassment. It's the class action waiver, because basically once it's written into an arbitration agreement, you can take away, you know, an employee or consumer's rights to proceed collectively, which for all practical purposes renders it completely impossible for them to pursue smaller claims for amounts that wouldn't make sense for them to pay a lawyer by the hour and wouldn't make sense for an attorney to pursue on a contingency fee basis. So there are a lot of ills with mandatory arbitration, but hopefully with respect to sex harassment, at least, there's enough momentum to find a solution.
All right. Well, if we haven't yet totally bored you with legislation, now I'm going to ask about tax legislation. So, and what can I say? You know, there have been a lot of changes afoot, and one relates to tax deductibility of settlements. And again, I'm going to let Chaya talk about that.
So it's the aptly named Harvey Weinstein provision, or at least nicknamed. And the idea was, again, to get at the confidentiality provisions in sex harassment. And this one is passed. This was part of the new tax law. And basically, the intent behind it was to say, all right, if you're an employer and you mandate that there's a confidentiality provision in your sex harassment settlement, you cannot deduct either the settlement payment itself or your attorney's fees associated with it. Those are both deductible expenses for an employer. Unfortunately, written in either intentionally or unwittingly was a reciprocity when it came to attorney's fees. And so there's some ambiguity in the law that that may apply also to employees, which makes no sense since the employees aren't the ones insisting on the confidentiality provisions in the first place. And two, if you tax an employee who pays by and large on a contingency fee basis, if they settle a case for $100,000, you know, they're getting 2/3 of that, so call it 66 1/3%. If they're taxed on $100,000, their net becomes minuscule. So in no way, shape, or form was this the spirit by which the Harvey Weinstein provision was pursued. So hopefully the IRS will clarify the law, but that is a bit of an issue in an otherwise successful effort, if you are focusing on confidentiality provisions.
And, you know, this, it's not on our list, so hopefully I can ask you about it, and you'll have an opinion. But, you know, one of the things that I keep hearing about is outrage that public entities are paying settlements. And, you know, from my point of view, I'm used to the fact that if you work somewhere and you get sued for behavior you do at work, then in most cases, it's the entity that sued, the entity that has the deep pockets, and the entity that pays. On the other hand, you have these very wealthy people themselves who are doing really outrageous behavior, and the entity is paying, which is not the norm. Is there legislation afoot about that, or do you know? Can you talk about that?
Well, I don't know if there's legislation. I have heard those complaints, yeah. and on the surface, at least, it makes some sense, right? You have tax dollars going towards often confidential settlements. But I really think that that has to be the case. I mean, you have a huge federal and state workforce. They are victims themselves of harassment and deserve compensation. And taxpayers will pay a lot more if public entities are constrained in managing that and they need to litigate everything to trial. So I think that's another instance where something that an understandable kind of intuition isn't, when fleshed out, the right solution.
People don't like how it sounds, and the reality is it's going to be hard to do business in any other way.
Go ahead. One thing that's come up as another idea is to expand the statute of limitations. So right now, for those that don't know, you got to move quickly. So unlike some other areas of employment law, like wage and hour, where you can pursue for up to 3 or even 4 sometimes years a failure of your employer to pay you overtime or a break from 4 years ago, when you come to harassment and discrimination as it exists now, you have 1 year, and that's it, at the state level, and the federal is even shorter, to file administrative charges to preserve your right to pursue this as a lawsuit. And there's some changes afoot in that regard at the state level.
Yeah, a proposal for a 3-year statute. I don't have a sense of whether it's going to pass or not. And I don't really see, the downside of longer statutes is that sometimes it's harder to get proof. So if I'm investigating something that happened years ago, then memories fade, emails disappear legitimately, and I may not have that much to work with. I am seeing that as a result, I think, of Me Too, employers are going back further regardless of the law. So they may get a complaint from something that happened 5 or 10 years ago, and if it's not very serious, they might say, we're not going to do anything at this point. But if it's serious, even though there wouldn't be liability, they're saying, we want to know about this. We want to, and especially if the people are still there in the workplace. And so there's sort of a weighing of how serious, how long ago, and a decision made to go back much further than I've seen, I think, before Me Too. And in terms of legally the statute going to 3 years, I don't see much of a downside, do you?
No, you know, I have to confess, it before kind of preparing for this talk, it wasn't really on my radar. I was aware of it, but I didn't really have much of an opinion. But the more I've thought about it, the more I think that's a really important change. And the reason I say that is because oftentimes victims fail to come forward because they're afraid of retaliation, and they're still working for the employer. And sometimes they're still working directly for the harasser because it's their boss or a managing official. So allowing them that time after a couple years, while, you know, ideally a report will be soon so that it can be corrected and evidence can be maintained, gives someone the flexibility. 2 years later, they may not be employed by that employer and they now feel comfortable doing it, or the harasser themselves may not be in their reporting chain or even at the employer. So it would kind of open the door to a subset of victims who don't feel comfortable in the status quo from reporting.
Yeah, but I do want to sort of clarify for folks that there is still, regardless of when the statute is, there are laws and rules that really encourage people to come forward as soon as possible. And so federal law, if you don't complain and there were good policies and you could have complained, there may be no liability. And state law, again, if the employer has good policies and would have done something and you don't complain, it limits your damages. And from the perspective of someone who does prevention, while I don't necessarily see a downside of a longer statute, I also think that it's really important to get people to complain sooner and deal with it sooner, and that it benefits everybody at work, because sometimes people haven't done anything really serious, but they've done something that they shouldn't have, and the sooner they are brought into line, the better it is, not just for them, not just for the target, but also for the person who is crossing those lines, that they learn, no, you can't do that. Here's what we expect out of you. Maybe then they can save their job instead of keeping being out of line to a point where it becomes more serious. Not good for anybody to wait. So I'm always interested in how can we get people to complain sooner, to deal with it sooner, and to move on, whether it's serious, there's going to be a termination, or there's going to be some other kind of response.
Well, one interesting technological innovation that came out of the EEOC's task force was a platform where employees can complain. Let's say there's behavior that they felt uncomfortable with but didn't feel comfortable raising it to HR. They could lodge it contemporaneously into a system, which A, lends some credibility to it having happened in the first place, but it would kind of stay there and be held in abeyance until a second person came forward with a similar report that matched to that person, and then they'd proceed to collectively, which I thought was an innovative tool and would probably encourage some people to come forward in that regard. Are there other efforts that you think are underfoot to improve post-Me Too workplace investigations or complaint reporting?
Well, again, if I go back to the bystander and the fact that anonymous complaints should be investigated, and that's in the guidelines that DFEH put out, that people are educated that they don't have to come forward. They can say, I saw this or I experienced this, and it's more environmental. They don't have to identify themselves, and there's an expectation of action. I'm seeing that maybe it's time for questions.
It is time in our program for audience questions. There are several here on corporate environment, and you've been talking mainly, it seems like, individuals and their sexual harassment complaints. But what if a company has a sexist corporate culture? The bad environment. Do you get involved in that? Do you have cases where people come and say this company just isn't friendly to women? And do you do those kind of investigations? Or
sure. I mean, usually it's coming first from an individual or a few individuals. And so an investigation might be a climate survey or assessment of an environment rather than focusing on one complaint. Or it might be that the employer is starting to realize that there's just a lot of unrest and problems in a work group. What's going on? Why are people unhappy in this work group? Or, you know, things that they're picking up on, and they say, you know, we want to outsource this and have you sometimes start with an anonymous survey, maybe have interviews with everybody in that work environment and put together a report of what that climate is like, sometimes with suggestions about how to change it.
Frank Dobbin at Harvard, who's one of the preeminent academics who's studying this on a statistical level or an empirical level, wrote an article recently that, and I'm paraphrasing, said something like, you want to fix sex harassment, training won't fix it, reporting won't fix it, hiring and promoting more women will.
And
his point was just empirically that if you look at companies that have women in management positions, they have a heck of a lot less problems with an environment conducive to sex harassment for a couple of reasons. One, because they're less likely to harass themselves in positions of power. And two, because of that culture, the environment changes when the leadership at the top is at least not all men and diverse in that respect.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Do company policies about fraternization have an impact on the quantity of sex harassment?
Anecdotally, I'd say yes. I'm not aware of any research, but certainly when I talk to prospective clients and they're relaying instances of harassment, particularly more severe, like physical conduct, I think at least to the extent alcohol is involved in company outings, then I've certainly noticed a prevalence. But I don't know more kind of on a macro level.
Well, certainly a lot of the complaints that we look at that are more serious or alcohol related. But I thought the question was about a fraternization policy itself. And
right.
And I don't know that I can correlate. I don't know if there's been research. I mean, some companies have policies about relationships between employees. And what I would say is that regardless of the policy, maybe it's the enforcement of, that I do think that employers that have a lot of fraternization going on, meaning that there are romantic relationships between employees, there is a higher degree of socializing, that people tend to cross lines, not read each other's cues, start a relationship and then end it, and it's no longer consent, and they have to deal with those issues. And so I certainly would say anecdotally, and maybe you're saying something similar in your answer. I don't know that the policy makes as much difference as the practice.
Right. Has there been a significant increase in sexual harassment cases in the past year since the Me Too movement?
I think so. I mean, again, I can tell you that we have a lot of work. we're very busy. And I would assume filings are up, but do you know?
I'd say the same. We're getting more calls. We got a lot of calls to begin with, so I don't want to kind of overstate the impact. Sex harassment was a big problem before the hashtag was invented.
Yeah.
How long has it been a big problem for? How long have you been practicing for?
Certainly for the, you know, going on 15 years, I've been practicing.
I've been practicing since the 1980s. And, mm-hmm. you know, I would have thought, haven't we solved this yet? I mean, we had the law, we had the theory, we had a lot of the same practice, and we haven't solved it. And that's what's stunning to me. And I don't know that I could say statistically it's changed. You would think that it has, but you get really powerful, you know, you get the set of the very powerful people who abuse that authority, and that's where I think that the Me Too movement has really stood up and said, no, you can't abuse that authority anymore. And then you get, like I said, the not as serious but pernicious situations of people who just keep crossing lines and aren't getting what appropriate behavior looks like, what respect looks like.
And when you say people, is it mostly?
It's mostly men.
Okay.
I mean, it's not only men, but it's mostly men. And we know that statistically, certainly, that about 90% of sexual harassment is male. I think it's about 90% is male to female. There's the second largest group is male to male, and the smallest group is female to female. We are talking about behavior, but yeah, it is a result, I think, of the kind of conditioning and sexism that people have been taught and grow up with, and sex role stereotyping, and often is related to power, but not always.
There's some questions about how do you determine if it's really harassment, like if someone's flirting. I mean, there's degrees of all these things, right? And I'm sure that's what a lot of your investigations are about. But how do you determine that?
I'm going to just get one line from training that I'll say. Equal initiation and participation. If somebody is standing there going, very funny, huh? That's not equal initiation and participation. If somebody says, that's a good joke, let me tell you one that's even better, that's equal initiation and participation.
Yeah, because and people's natures are all different. Some people are naturally on the flirtation. I mean, there's so many nuances to this, but I'd imagine that's why you have your training. And there are a lot of questions about the training. For example, will you be looking at effectiveness of computerized versus in-person training? Do you have an opinion on that, on whether one or the other is more effective?
That is definitely one of the things we'll be looking at. It has to be an interactive training, meaning there has to be opportunities for employees to ask questions and to have that back and forth. You can't just put on a video and leave. But it can be live or it can be computer assisted. And so there's a lot of data now that exists about how that's been implemented and what and whether one or the other is more effective.
I'm starting to see some decent interactive video-based training. But for the most part, it's been stilted and not very helpful. And, you know, it treats people, excuse me for saying, but like idiots, you know? I mean, and live training, if you take into consideration that you're really having a conversation with people and there's nuance, can be effective. But, it does depend on if you're really engaging.
And has the Me Too movement changed your training for your workplace investigators?
I've already developed some pretty rigorous training, so I can't think of a direct change to the training so much as people, I'm doing more investigator training. People are recognizing that there are a lot of folks in EEO departments and in HR that need more training. And that they're more willing to engage and to put some resources into that.
This is a great question. Why not approach the problem like family law does more, where there's mediation, a choice of litigation, mediation? Well, that's what you were talking about earlier.
I think in some cases it's appropriate, but you know, it depends. When you have unequal power, when you have somebody who's really been abusive, then mediation is not a good forum. If you have two coworkers and there's miscommunications and it's more equal, then mediation is often a good forum. But that's what I mean by we sort of have one solution to anything that comes under this huge category of harassment. And it shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all. But at this point, it kind of is.
Yeah, and you know, family law gets a lot. There's a lot, justifiably, of overlap. They're both very human areas of the law. They deal with intimate relationships. But I think it can be overstated, the parallel. Family law has a lot of mandatory mediation and arbitration components. And the rationale is that oftentimes both parties are better off if an agreement is reached, and they can't get there. But when you have kids and other joint factors, that actually it's not a zero-sum game. And employment law is a little different. If it's a continued employment relationship, then sometimes that's the case. But oftentimes it's not. An employer was fired and then sues or leaves because of harassment. And then it really is more of a zero-sum game. And so I think structurally, there's not as much overlap in that respect as people think with family.
Yeah, I think the mediation is when there's early intervention and people are still working together, and it's not the kind of action that would be terminable. Certainly, you're not going to take predatory behavior and send that to mediation.
On this confidentiality issue, doesn't confidentiality sometimes benefit the victim as well because they can negotiate a stronger settlement? I mean, that's what it's all about, right, is negotiation. And the confidentiality piece is part of that.
That's exactly what Chaya was saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the first thing that happens if you take away, if you mandate that employers can't include confidentiality provisions, is that the victims of sexual harassment that I represent make, you know, get half as much for their in damages for the abuse they've suffered and are unable to settle claims in the first place. So I have concerns. I think people need to pause as that being the focal point for solution on this.
In most of those cases where it is confidential, is the perpetrator fired or do they get to keep their job because it's kept quiet? You know, no one's talking about it. So the company doesn't really have to do anything.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts. Once it gets to outside counsel and we're sending a demand letter or filing a complaint, more the demand letter, which is the confidential, once you file the complaint, it's out there. Almost always it leads to a separation of employment, usually voluntarily because it's awkward for both sides. Have to be the case.
But is the question whether the complainant is separated or the person who did the harassing?
The person who did the harassing.
That really varies. And there are times that the company, you know, will stand by that person, and there are times when they won't. And you know, sometimes I think they've made the right call and sometimes not. You know, it's so fact specific. Chaya, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I think anecdotally, I have seen a change post Me Too of that. I think employers, both for reasons that are kind of self-preservation minded and otherwise, are much more quick to harshly discipline an alleged harasser. In part because they know, even if they're settling this case, the next case, if that harasser's still there and there's a second allegation of harassment, that's going to be a huge jury verdict in a Me Too movement environment.
So that could be seen as a positive change of the Me Too movement.
Yeah,
I think so.
Should we end on a positive note?
Yeah. Always a good idea.
Actually, we do have time for one last question. So I'm going to try and find one here that will be fairly easy to answer. Well, here's one about the legal standard for sex harassment. The legal standard is very high, severe and pervasive. Let's see if you agree with that. While companies' policies may prohibit misconduct that doesn't rise to that level, do you think the fact that the standard is so high discourages people from acting better?
I don't. I mean, I do think that almost all companies prohibit any unwanted behavior, and that there should be a difference between what happens that results in discipline and what happens that results in a lawsuit, that there should be a separation between the seriousness of those.
What she said.
either, if it was only that way all the time.
Do either of you have any parting comments that you'd like to say on this topic to leave your audience here and listening audience with?
Well, I'd just like to thank, in addition to our friends and family, all three of you that we don't know for showing up here tonight.
Ditto.
Ditto? Okay. All right. Well, our thanks to Amy Oppenheimer and Chaya Mandelbaum for our comments here today. We also thank our audiences here as well as our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.